We're carrying on our series looking at how to live life in light of the future. I'm more and more convinced, as I kind of read the Bible and reflect on the Christian life, that we do this kind of double looking of looking back to the cross and resurrection, as we've been doing with the Lord's Supper, and how that shapes life now, and how we look forward at all that will happen when Jesus returns. And that shapes life. Now, that might be a very profound thought, looking back, looking forward. I think I probably thought that a long time ago. But perhaps the depth of that, the great shaping that gives to life now, has been striking me more. And this series, we're very much looking at the forward aspect of it. And we're going to be focusing on this parable in Luke's Gospel. I want us to start, though, by thinking about why it is we do whatever it is we do. Think about your life. Think about how you spend your time during the week, what you'd spend your money on, put your energy into. You know, so you're thinking of your work, your studies, your hobbies, your interests, your responsibilities. You're thinking about how you spend your days. Why do you do what you do? I imagine for many it's a case of, well, because I have to. There's not a lot of choice in some areas, you know, work, looking after the kids, whatever it is. You have to. Some things will be because you want to. You enjoy what you do. You enjoy your hobbies or your films or whatever it is. Perhaps for many of us it's actually just because it's roughly what everyone else does. You know, there's a sort of pattern to life, a shape to life, that just kind of gets handed on to us, or that we just see around us, and we just make our own little tweaks here and there because of our personal preferences. The reason I start with that question, which I know is pretty broad and sort of vague and stuff, but the reason I begin with it is because why we do something cuts to the heart of how we view life now. Our motivations now as to why we do what we do reveal what we think life is really about. I mean, take the crass end of it. Our kids got, I don't know if they got given or we bought it. They play the game of life. Play the game of life? Hands up who's played the game of life. Board game. Yeah? Who wins? The one with the most money at the end. Amazing. Ah. What are we teaching our children? Anyway, they play the game. Yeah. That's one view of life. It's the crass end of the spectrum. You know, it's all about getting the most money at the end. One with the most toys wins. Well, perhaps we know that isn't true. But do I think of life as, well, I enjoy myself as much as I can, and I'm as much of a success as I could be, while being quite nice and serving other people on the way? Or is it all about serving other people, but then just sort of hoping, well, maybe I can get a little bit of enjoyment and success on the way? See, how I answer these sorts of questions will shape how I spend my time and my money and my energy. They will affect my decisions, my attitude. And that is what I think this parable in Luke is all about. Notice, first of all, why Jesus tells it. Verse 11, Luke 19, verse 11. While they were listening to this, he, Jesus, went on to tell them a parable because he was near Jerusalem and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. Jesus has been talking about the kingdom of God coming, God's promises of rule and blessing and renewal from the Old Testament coming true. An expectation has been running high as Jesus gets closer and closer to Jerusalem, which is presumed to be the place where the showdown will happen. So people think it's about to happen. And so Jesus tells them a story. He said, verse 12, a man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return. Now, that might seem a bit weird. Why does somebody go off to another country to get appointed? It'd be, you know, assuming Prince Charles becomes king at some point, with all the hilarity that might involve. It would be a bit like him going off to Paris or something to be appointed king of England. And we kind of go, what? Weird. Well, it's not weird if the country you are in is ruled by another country. The real power base is elsewhere. And this is actually what happened. Kings in Israel would travel to Rome, which was the head of the Roman Empire, the power base. There they would be appointed king and then return to be king over some little region in Israel. And so Jesus is using this idea to speak about himself. He is this man of noble birth, and he will be made king. But it's not going to happen straight away. He's going to go elsewhere, to a distant country, to be appointed king. Later on, he'll return and bring the kingdom with him. If you remember, back in January, this is what we saw at the beginning of this series. It began with a very big picture where Jesus does come and does bring the kingdom in some sense, but there is then a period of waiting for him to return. Because in Jerusalem, he won't be crowned, he'll be crucified. And he won't start his rule, he'll face rejection. But then, in the resurrection and in the ascension, God the Father appoints Jesus as king. He gives him the name that's above every name. And he promises him that one day every knee will bow before him and every tongue confess that he's Lord. But not yet. He goes and is appointed, and then he will return. And so Jesus is saying, yes, the kingdom's coming. Yes, I'll be king one day, but not yet. He's going to go away. You're going to have to wait. And what he's concerned about is how we wait. He is concerned fundamentally as to whether we will be faithful servants while he is away. Faithful servants. See verse 13. He called 10 of his servants. He gave them 10 minas or minas or something, bits of money. Put this money to work, he said, until I come back. He gives his disciples, his servants, resources and the command to get on with certain responsibilities while he's away. Now, people have often tried to pin down exactly what this money represents. For example, they say, the money is the gospel we're entrusted with and the responsibility is to get on with spreading it. Or the resources, the money is a picture of the Holy Spirit or certain gifts or something. I don't think we need to pin it down like that. I think the picture is simply that of being given resources and being expected to get on with using them in the master's absence. To be faithful with what he's given while he's gone. And to do so in a context where not everyone recognizes his position as king. See verse 14. But his subjects hated him and sent a delegation after him to say, we don't want this man to be our king. Some resist this guy being appointed. They don't want him ruling. There's nothing they can do about it. He is made king. But we may as well jump ahead to the end just to see what happens to these guys. Verse 27, Jesus calls them his enemies who didn't want him to be king over them. Bring them here and kill them in front of me. This is a picture of those who will not bow to Jesus. We've seen last week the sobering realities of punishment for those who resist. Let me say again, Jesus calls people to bow the knee to him before he returns. Do you see that he is the king that God has appointed? Have you bowed before him, accepted his offer of forgiveness, come back under his rule? If you haven't, please, please think that through. Talk to us about that. Because one day he'll return and he will punish those who oppose him, who are enemies. The main focus of the story, though, is on the servants. Those who are living for him while he's gone, even in a context where not everybody recognizes that he's the king you should be living for. He's worried about how they live in his absence. Back in verse 15, he comes back, he returns home. He sent for the servants to whom he'd given the money. Why? In order to find out what they had gained with it. What have you done with what I gave you? How have you used it? How have you acted as my servants in my absence? You see, life now is shaped around this day to come, a day where we stand in front of the Lord Jesus and he asks us what we've done with what he gave us. Now that completely changes how I view life now. Life now, you see, is not, well, I live my life and I enjoy what I happen to enjoy. I do the work that I happen to have found myself in or that I wanted to do, and I do my hobbies. And around the edges, I squeeze in a bit of time for Jesus. I suppose I should do something at church. I'll help out of the youth group. I could fit that in, or whatever it might be. If that's how we think, and someone encourages us to be sort of more committed to Jesus or something, we just think, oh, well, I ought to perhaps cut back a bit more on me time and give a bit more Jesus time. That's not the picture. That's not it. The picture is all of life lived as Jesus' servants, having been entrusted with resources from him. All of my time, all of my money, all of my energy has been given to me. And all of life is lived knowing one day he'll say, Graham, Joe, what have you done? What have you done with what I gave you? How have you used it? What sort of servant have you been while I've been away? Well, in this story, there were 10. We're only told about 3 of them, but enough to get the picture. The first one comes and says in verse 16, Sir, your miner has earned 10 more. And Jesus replies, well done, my good servant, because you've been trustworthy in a very small matter, take charge of 10 cities. See what he says. Look at those words. Well done. I'm pleased with you. You've been a good servant. You have been trustworthy. Well, we could translate that word faithful or reliable. That is the key. A good servant to whom Jesus says, well done, is the one who has been trustworthy or faithful with what they've been given. Trustworthy in what he's entrusted. Faithful in living for him and serving him. And so again, life now is all about living for my absent master. Faithfully serving my king who'll return. Because I'll stand before him. And he'll ask what I've done. I think it's important to try and get the feel of this right. Jesus isn't going to be standing there kind of, tapping his foot and kind of like, right, what have you done? What have you got to show for yourself? Come on, where is it? Demanding, critical, looking, you messed up there, didn't you? I don't think that's the right feel. But he will ask what I've done with my time and money and energy. He'll ask, has life been lived faithful to me? Has it been focused on me at all? Oh, sure, you may have messed up in all sorts of things, but he's the gracious king. The gracious king who died for us to bring us forgiveness. I mean, my failures will be revealed before him, but they'll be forgiven failures. They're still revealed, I think, because it's right that all of my life is now seen with respect to Jesus. But the fundamental question is, it's kind of the orientation of my life. Have I been trying to live with him as king? Serving him what he gave me? And so I want to ask us, is this how we view life? Accountable to Jesus and so wanting to be faithful to Jesus while he's gone. Or to put it differently, living life now for the commendation and reward of that day. And he does reward, doesn't he? Verse 17 goes on. Take charge of 10 cities. The next guy comes. He's got 5 more. You take charge of 5 cities. Jesus rewards people for faithfulness to him. Now, there are several things to say about this sort of reward. This is not a wage earned. This isn't people saying, I've put the hours in, Jesus. I've got this, so give us what I'm owed. That is not the feel for it at all. This is a gift given from the Master. He doesn't have to give it. He's not obliged to give it. He wants to reward faithfulness. And so he chooses to generously give gifts. Secondly, this is not supposed to be a story about enlightened self-interest that says, well, if I really go for it for Jesus now, I'll be so much better off then. So, quid's in the future. That's not the attitude. I think these servants are concerned about the gifts they might get. They're concerned to be faithful to their master. This is relational to him, not some kind of look at the books, oh, I'll be better off that way. And thirdly, this is not about me giving to Jesus just so that he'll pay me back. Oh, I suppose I could give some of my money to Jesus, then I'll get more in the future. It's about how I use what he gave to me. It's given on trust. Interestingly, the servants say in verse 16 and in 18, Sir, your miner has earned 10 more or 5 more. It's like it's done it. And I was in charge of it, I was stewarding it, but it's not me. And so this is only about being a good steward with what he gives us in the first place. And so it's long been said and often been said that in giving rewards, God is only crowning his own gifts. He's only giving a blessing for how we used what he gave us, crowning his own gifts. But having said all that, this is still clearly to be an incentive to faithfulness now, isn't it? Jesus wants us to know he cares about how his servants live while he's gone. The Christian life is not believe in Jesus, book your place in heaven, hang on for it. Batten down the hatches, it'll come soon. The Christian life is have Jesus as your king, live life waiting for him to return and rule, and so be faithful to him in the meantime. And know that he cares about how we live. It matters to him, and he will generously reward people for what they've done. And so Jesus speaks elsewhere about reward for how we use our money, and about reward for bearing in persecution and hardship. And the Apostle Paul talks about reward in our ministry for Jesus in building the church. And we are to see that all we do in life, Jesus is bothered about, and he loves to reward faithfulness. Now, people have speculated about what this reward will actually look like. Do I get a bigger house? You know, do I get to do a little bit of celestial off-roading while someone else only gets a go-kart or something? I don't think we're told. This parable, actually, one of the reasons I picked it is because it probably gets as close to describing it as anything in terms of talking about more responsibility in the new creation when Jesus returns. You've been faithful and trustworthy, so take charge of more. And it may well be that the reward has something to do with that future entrusting. Because life in the future is still about living faithfully for Jesus. It's just that he's now there as king. It's not that life in the future just becomes a sort of the endless church service around the throne. No, new creation, physical creation, responsibility over the world. And it may be that rewards have something to do with that increased responsibility. But it's a parable, and so I wouldn't want to push that too far. And I'm not sure it's really worth speculating. The point is that Jesus notices and cares, and while he doesn't owe us anything, he will graciously reward faithfulness. And so we can and should say there will be degrees of reward, even within the equal inheritance that all his people get. People have spoken about things like degrees of happiness, even in a world of perfect joy, and that sort of thing. But however we picture it, it is to encourage us faithful to be faithful now. Or to put it negatively, it is to warn us of this third servant. Verse 20. Sir, here is your miner. I kept it laid away in a bit of cloth. I was afraid of you because you're a hard man. You take out what you did not put in and reap what you did not sow. Now notice that this guy is wrong in his thinking about his master. He thinks he's a hard man. In what way? Well, that he takes out what he didn't put in. That is, he kind of works off other people without contributing himself. He reaps where he didn't sow. He didn't make any investment, but he likes to take the reward anyway. Which is precisely what didn't happen. The master gave them his own resources to use. And so the master says in verse 22, he'll use this guy's words as the basis for his judgment. You thought I was like that, did you? That I was a hard guy? Well, if you'd thought like that, verse 23, you should have just put it on deposit. I could have got the interest. In other words, he hasn't even acted in line with what he says. This is, I think, a simple excuse for his irresponsibility and his lack of care over what he's been given. And the result is Jesus calls him, notice, verse 22, a wicked servant, not a good servant. And verse 24, this miner is taken away and given to someone else. People have slightly debated what this pictures. It could mean being in the kingdom still, but losing the generous reward the master would have given. That's quite a possibility. It could be worse. It could be not being in the kingdom at all. Because the servant who acts like this isn't very different to the enemies. All I would say is there shouldn't be much confidence in waiting for Jesus to return while living like this. So how are we living while Jesus is away? Are we looking forward to the day where we hear his words of commendation, well done, good and faithful servant? Just think about applying this a little bit. I've mentioned that elsewhere in the New Testament, this idea of rewards or treasure in the future is applied to how we use our money, our possessions. It's applied to how we work in our secular jobs, for example. No matter what reward you get for your job that you do in the office or wherever, know that God will reward all of your good work. Paul says that in Ephesians. How we work in building the church and so on. It's applied to all areas of life. In all areas, the question I have to ask myself is, am I faithfully serving Jesus with what he's entrusted me? Take money as an example. Rather than beginning with all I need to spend my money on and what I'd like to spend the money left over on, and then thinking, well, how much might I be able to give to the work of the kingdom in some way? Surely the approach to use from this parable would be this. How would Jesus want me to use my money? Which, of course, means paying the bills and so on, because he'd want me to do that. And God gives us good things for us to enjoy, so it doesn't mean I don't ever go on holiday or anything. But my fundamental attitude is, how does Jesus want me to use this? He gave it to me. And because he gave it to me, I want to be faithful, trustworthy. That may well mean I use it differently. It may mean I use it the same way, but actually with a rather different attitude to life. And we could do the same thing with the time that Jesus gives us, and the same thing with our gifts and our abilities and so on. It seems to me that when we talk about being faithful to Jesus, we often immediately think in our heads of some climactic moment of faithfulness. You know, I mentioned Polycarp last week being threatened with death, and would he prove faithful to Jesus in that moment? There's a climactic moment. You're going to be faithful, or are you going to renounce Christ? Well, some of us do end up facing such moments. Big decisions in life where honouring Jesus comes down to a do it or don't do it sort of decision. And those moments are there, and we should be faithful to Jesus in them. But the point from this parable, I think, is the great challenge for us is not faithfulness to Jesus in the climactic moments of life. It's faithfulness to Jesus in the ordinary moments of life. The ordinary ways I choose to spend my time and my money, and the attitude that I do that with. Faithfulness to Jesus in the ordinary, while he's away, before I stand before him and he asks me what I've done with what he gave me. Let's stop there. We just got a couple of minutes. Not too long, I'm afraid, but I imagine there may well be some questions. So why not just turn to your neighbour for a second, or just sit and think by yourself. Questions you've got or implications you see, we'll have a couple of moments of feeding back in a second, but let's just get us each thinking about what we've learnt from that. Talk to your neighbour for a second. Go. Okay, I'm sorry not to give you longer, but our time is almost gone. Just time for a couple of questions or contributions, if people got some particular areas of application or something to add that I've certain to have missed out. Wave a hand. My wife.
Well, I just need to
Thank you. If you didn't hear that, Karis referring to 1 Timothy 5 about the good deeds of a widow, just as an example of the sorts of things that God thinks are really worthwhile, like bringing up children, showing hospitality, washing the feet of the Lord's people, which I take it as a picture of service generally, helping those in trouble, devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds. It's just faithfulness in all that ordinary stuff of life. We must see that as significant in God's eyes. Thank you.